Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A First Nations man believes drones can be used to deliver medical supplies and emergency equipment to remote reserves in Canada. Another Ojibwe man uses drones to map sites for tribal construction projects. The technology for small remote-controlled aircraft is advancing quickly, and some Native enthusiasts are exploring ways to use them for business, public safety, and to strengthen cultural connections. We'll hear more after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coalition of tribes and Western conservationists are working to protect more public lands before the November presidential election. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
On Tuesday, the coalition was joined by members of Congress in front of the U.S. Capitol. They called on the Biden administration to expand and designate more national monuments, which are permanently protected lands. That includes creating the Basawabi Swamp Cedars National Monument in Nevada, the Dolores Canyons National Monument in Colorado, and several in California, such as the Quitson National Monument. Here's Councilman Donald Medart of the Fort Yuma Quitson Indian Tribe.
This is our history book. To be able to go out into the desert, to show my children and to show other tribal members and community members, this is who the Quitson people are. This is where we came from. These are lands that we traverse. These are what our songs talk about. And it gives it that much more meaning to our people.
In all, the coalition is pushing for 11 new or expanded protected lands. The group presented a petition of more than 800,000 signatures in support of their efforts. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
The lieutenant governor of Minnesota, who's Native American, is traveling to several states to try to help President Joe Biden's re-election bid. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM in Milwaukee reports on the efforts of Peggy Flanagan.
Flanagan is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and has served as Minnesota's lieutenant governor since 2019. This year, with Minnesota considered safe political territory for Joe Biden, Flanagan, a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, has been traveling to swing states to campaign for Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Last weekend, Flanagan spoke in Wisconsin. She says, for one thing, she believes in the Biden-Harris ticket.
But two is because, as a Native woman, it is my responsibility to make sure that I am caring for my community, but also ensuring that we are strong into the future. I'm a mom of an 11-year-old girl, and I want her to know that voting is a tradition in our family. It's how we show up for each other. It's how we actively care for each other.
Flanagan says President Biden has brought billions of dollars in federal money to Indian country and has a record of standing up for tribal families.
The compassion with which he has approached a lot of these issues around boarding schools and the federal boarding school system, shining a light on that has been incredibly powerful. You know, he fought to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act before the Supreme Court and won, which I think many of us were holding our breath and were so relieved that that was protected.
And Flanagan says Biden chose Native American Deb Haaland as Interior Secretary. But as NPR has reported, Republicans hope Donald Trump can win votes among tribes with promises of improving schools, job creation, and safe communities. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Judge Sarah Hill, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, was ceremonially sworn in to the federal bench in Tulsa, Oklahoma last week. The Cherokee Phoenix reports, among a crowd of nearly 200 people, Hill was welcomed as a new judge for the Northern District of Oklahoma. Hill's the former Attorney General of the Cherokee Nation and made history with her confirmation in December. She's the first female Native American federal judge in Oklahoma. Tribes and national Native organizations say Hill brings a critical perspective and deep knowledge of federal Indian law. There are 39 federally recognized tribes in the state. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Drones have applications that extend far beyond video and photography, which is how many of us think of them. Tribes in places like Oklahoma and even in remote regions of the Amazon are looking at the potential benefits of unmanned aircraft vehicles. One company in Canada, Indigenous Aerospace, has hopes for drones to deliver medicine to remote Indigenous communities in Canada. Other native drone operators focus on construction, 3D modeling, and documenting historical sites. Today on the show, we'll talk about how native people use drones not only for business, but also to aid communities. Join our conversation. Does your community fly drones? Are you a drone operator yourself? Share your comments and questions by calling into the show at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also comment on our website or social media pages. Joining us now from Calgary, Alberta, in Canada, is Jacob Taylor. He is the CEO of Indigenous Aerospace, and he's a member of Curve Lake First Nation. Hello, Jacob, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Hey, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and I love that number, 1-800-99-NATIVE. That's easy to remember.
You like that? Yeah, yeah. We make it easy for our listeners, Jacob. Also joining us today on the show from Daisy, Oklahoma, is James Grimsley. He is the Executive Director of Advanced Technology Initiatives for the Choctaw Nation. Hello, James, and welcome to our show as well.
Halito, glad to be here.
Halito. And joining us from Mount Pleasant, Michigan, is Robert Hart. He is the owner and chief pilot of LIDAR Drone Services and the founder of Powwow Jams. He is Ho-Chunk and Ojibwe. Hello, Robert. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hope everybody's having a great day.
We are having a great day, and it's only going to get better when we start this conversation. Jacob, let's go ahead and kick off with you. Aside from being the CEO of Indigenous Aerospace, you're also a PhD candidate in the Indigenous Health Program at the University of North Dakota. How do you connect health sciences and drones?
Yeah, that's an interesting, story that everyone wants to know about. And, for me, I did health science for my undergrad, First Nation policy leadership for my master's, and then now, yes, I'm a PhD candidate in the inaugural Indigenous Health Program, PhD program at the University of North Dakota, which is a world first. And of course, University of North Dakota is heavily involved in aerospace sciences, particularly remote piloted aircraft systems within those sciences. So it was a really serendipitous thing for me to, find the study, but also, sort of happy accident how I got into it. So, as I first started as an entrepreneur with a health science and a policy background, Canada was happening to do something in an innovative regulatory environment, similar to what we're doing with drones as a nascent of regulatory development in the country. And that, of course, was international news with our legalization of cannabis. And so I first started out, applying my health background, business acumen, and policy background with First Nations, helping to navigate Health Canada's regulatory structure to participate in cannabis cultivation, and then later on cannabis, sales, retail sales. So that was really interesting. And I had to do a lot of educational work, very similar again to our drone work. Not a lot of clients are aware of what they can do and where we're going with regulations and the possibilities of the future. And so I found myself in remote northern Ontario, Canada, working with a community tribal council to educate people on the cannabis possibilities. And unfortunately, a young woman died in a neighboring community, and everyone was really upset. You know, a woman died as a result of an oxygen apparatus running out within her community nursing station, and the weather and the time of day at night made it unsafe for a helicopter to be able to move that medical equipment over, you know, 70 kilometers straight as the crow flies. And it became, you know, how could we prevent a death like this from happening? And, you know, while that story made national news and was quite sensational as a result of the, you know, the advocacy work that her husband and sons did, it's still a common problem across all communities in Canada. And, you know, I really think globally, because, you know, the settler mindset of the past was to sort of push us out of the premium spots because they wanted those for their own colonization efforts, and have us sort of on the margins, you know, of society. Even my community, Curve Lake, was originally titled Mud Lake because, you know, they thought the area was so poor and muddy waters that nothing could really flourish there. But, you know, here we are, still resilient people standing and thriving within the body politic of Canada. And so, yeah, it became, you know, how can we move these things by drones? And partnered with another major operator here in the country and did some pilot projects and showed proof of concept to Indigenous Services Canada, Health Canada, community, myself, you know, the operators at the time that, yeah, we can do this. And so, you know, as I started exploring that health solution, you know, we can see that a lot of companies are after that. And there's drone delivery companies that are like on the California exchange too in the States, and, you know, operating in Indigenous contexts, say in Africa. This is really going all around the world. And what regulators are sort of looking for is to prove this technology out in places with high value need but sparse populations, you know, and also someone who can pay the bill. And so we look at this in Canada, and that makes First Nation, you know, healthcare a prime audience. And many companies are after that. But, you know, we just recently adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People in Canada. It received royal assent in June 2021. So, you know, it's something that is in our legislature and is working towards. And Article 3 is self-determination, right? That we as First Peoples can do this for ourselves. And so, you know, I look at the drone market as it expands. You know, we need to get better logistics into our communities, even beyond health, with things like heavy equipment parts, for example. But again, health is, you know, my primary focus.
And, okay.
You know, there's
Jacob.
Yeah, we can do this. Yeah, sorry, I just keep rambling. Go ahead.
No. This is great. This is all information. And the idea here, the possibilities that through drone technology, you could save lives by being able to transport medicine, that is just absolutely so inspiring. Is the technology there, though? Is it available? Are you at the point where you have the capability to carry medical equipment to areas that aren't easily accessible by other means?
Yes, and we've done trials where, like, we race an ambulance to, you know, dense trafficked area, like traffic congestion, or the top of a ski hill, and we're able to get an AED there faster, you know? And I've seen some other studies out of, like, Nevada, Arizona, where they've been moving snake venom, you know, to people who are in the field and need it. You know, with in line with that, I'm sure you could put an EpiPen for anyone who's having, you know, an allergic reaction, has gone into anaphylactic shock. You know, and so these use cases are here now today. Move blood, move vaccines, move sample kits. But, you know, the oxygen apparatus and the example that motivated me to get into this space, you know, that's too heavy a payload right now. So yes, it's here, but it's not here in the full meaningful way that the future is going to bring. And that's okay. Due to regulatory unfolding. So, like, right now we have 25 kilogram maximum takeoff weight drones. By April 2025 in our regulatory space in Canada, we're going to have 150 kilogram maximum takeoff weight. So now we're going to start to get into more meaningful payload delivery in terms of, you know, larger medical supplies and things like that. We're also unfolding our beyond visual line of sight regulations in Canada, which is going to allow the drone to travel further. You know, most operations that I've been on today either operate within visual line of sight, so we're only delivering 3 to 5 kilometers, or extended visual line of sight where, you know, we can see it so far on the mainland, and as it gets to the island nation, they take over the controls and bring the drone in and land. But soon in Canada, just by 1 year from now, all of that's going to rapidly grow of opportunity windows within the regulatory sphere.
Okay.
That's where we're going to see some more meaningful changes and impact. But the technology is there. It's just regulatory catch-up. Yep.
Okay. And in the future, it's coming soon. Drones with higher payload capacity and also being able to travel further distances. Jacob, tell us a little bit about the types of drones you're using now. What do these machines look like? How much do they cost? What do our listeners need to understand about this technology?
Sure. I mean, right now, we're typically using multi-rotors versus fixed-wing aircraft. So they're quadcopters. You know, they have four rotors, very classic drone, I think, that everyone's used to. And for me right now, I stick mostly, you know, within the DJI wheelhouse for community when I'm doing the training to build skills, because, you know, we're not a service delivery business. We build the capacity of the communities to do this work for themselves, because it's really attainable for us and does so much to give people, you know, good careers. And, you know, seeing the flying robots moving in community, young people become obsessed with science, technology, engineering, math career, curriculum and careers. So, you know, the parallel benefits, the lateral benefits are immensely awesome. Even DJI just came out with the new cargo drone. That's very affordable. Like, this thing's only $25,000 Canadian. You know, again, it's moving this smaller payload. But to start out practicing the skills, getting your standard operating procedures in place before the larger aircraft come into effect, this is all great, right? And so, yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now. Is, you know, people are spending, say, $50,000 on the remote powered aircraft system to get this up and running, and close to that, like, you know, $30,000 to get the training and everything in effect. Because, of course, you come out of the lessons and it's so much new jargon, right? You have the aerospace science jargon to remember, the regulatory stuff to remember. So, yeah, there's always ongoing learning and coaching, but I'm really impressed with the clients that have taken this on. And on a secondary thing to comment with that, in Canada, I've been really impressed with Indigenous Services Canada's funding, which has been, you know, acclimating to the drone environment and getting their feet wet and funding drone projects in the last year. So this is even becoming more attainable for us, you know, as First Peoples in Canada.
We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back. We're going to talk with our other guests, specifically James Grimsley and also Robert Hart. These folks on our show today, they are all experts on drone technology, and they are using drones in interesting applications throughout Native America. Give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Immunizations save lives, but Native Americans consistently lag behind the rest of the population when it comes to immunization rates. Myths about the dangers of immunizations is increasing hesitation by parents, and public health officials say that puts children further at risk of serious diseases. We'll hear about an effort to improve Native vaccine rates on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are looking at innovative applications that tribes and Native people and communities have for drones. If you have a comment or question, join us at 1-800-996-2848. Let's take our first caller of the day, James, who is listening on KYUK in Bethel, Alaska. Good morning, James, and welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. We turned on the radio and wondered what KYUK had to say, and drones was the topic. So I'm excited to talk with you.
Yeah, I understand you run a drone club.
Yes, I work with Upward Bound T3 here in Alaska, and we have a thriving drone club of about 20 students. We've got one student who's passed his FAA licensure, and we actually did a mission here with the local health service where we flew from the hospital to a supply warehouse and back. So we've started the process out here.
Well, that's really exciting. So glad you tuned in today, James. And did you have a question for our first guest, Jacob?
Yes, I was listening to Jacob and just getting excited about everything he's saying. I'm also about to start my PhD, so there was a lot of connections there. But my general question is, he mentioned work in the public and the private spheres, and there is lots of interest in the public sphere and obviously opportunities in the private. Students are interested in being entrepreneurs, but also helping the community. So I just wondered if he had any feedback about the blessings and curses of each of those and how he kind of navigates the middle road between public and private work.
All right. Thanks for that question, James. Let's let Jacob respond. Jacob, pros and cons of public and private sector applications of drones. Students want to know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, each is a different audience that you service, you know, that has their own outcomes that they desire. And that can be challenging as an Indigenous person, too, right? Because sometimes the public values, especially, can be more orientated towards profit, whereas like our First Nation values more align us with like people and the planet. So this is definitely a challenge that you got to work out. Again, I mentioned, you know, self-determination of our people. It's something that by advancing, you know, more of a focus on people and the planet rather than profit, we're also steering like a political thing. So, you know, I encourage young people as they look at this for a business to have a 4P business model. Like, you got to make profit to sustain in business, but also how can you look after people and like particularly our people, you know, Native American people, Alaska Native people, First Nation people, right? And then of course the planet is really important, and a lot of drone work is like monitoring the environment and the health of the environment. So you can get on board with so many projects, you know, that work towards that. So yeah, a way that you can come together with a 4P model, it's not easy, but there are resources out there. You know, I'm always open to a call for mentorship. Lots of other, you know, business development officers across Indian country, both in Canada and the U.S., can provide you insight. And, you know, we're really fortunate, too, that a lot of public sector businesses are recognizing the importance of Indigenous procurement, of having Indigenous service companies, you know, working in tandem with them and their needs. So, you know, don't be afraid to knock on those doors and open them.
All right, great information, Jacob. Appreciate responding to our caller, James, from Bethel, Alaska. Let's bring James Grimsley into the conversation now, Executive Director of Advanced Technology Initiatives for the Choctaw Nation. He's in Oklahoma. James, welcome to the show again. A few years back, the Choctaw Nation purchased about 44,000 acres of land and established an aviation test range. What got the nation interested in drones?
Long story. I actually grew up in the reservation, so both sides of my family go back multiple generations, and you know, I grew up immersed in Choctaw culture. When I grew up here, it was a very impoverished area, and we had generational poverty and all the, you know, all the different impacts that come from that. It was a time when if you moved off to go to college, you typically didn't come back, and because there wasn't a lot of opportunity to come back to. So, you know, I grew up at a time when you could still go to college and work minimum wage jobs and pay your tuition and your cheap rent, which I was able to do. I was the first generation college graduate in my family. But I was very fortunate that I started pursuing aerospace engineering. Had a great career in the defense industry for about 20 years or so. And I apologize a little bit. I have an allergy-induced cough today, so I may cough a little bit. I apologize. But spent 20 years in the defense industry, always working on some form of emerging aviation, you know, early drones, cruise missiles, things like that. Then I went to academia. I was an associate vice president for research at the University of Oklahoma, where I was managing the applied research portfolio, but we were very heavily focused on aerospace and a lot of the emerging aviation technologies. So at some point in my career before the university, I realized that that must be my destiny is emerging aviation. So that's when I really started to focus on it. So while I was at the university, we were doing some neat stuff and some groundbreaking work with UAS there. The Choctaw Nation reached out to me. A lot of people that are in leadership now in the tribe were people that I grew up with. So we knew each other as kids. We were all poor, but it was still a neat time to grow up in rural Oklahoma. It was not a lot of neat things for kids to do. And so we, you know, a lot of good friendships there. But they reached out to me with a little bit of a vague proposition. They said, we bought this property. We'd like to come down, just if you can, spend a day with us, and we'd like to talk to you about it. I actually knew the property. My great-grandmother was born right at the very south tip of it. And so my family literally is within about a 15-mile radius, both sides of the southern tip of this large property. But while I was here, we were touring it. It's beautiful, pristine property, just as I remembered it. Lots of hills, just beautiful forests. They said, we would like to do something in aviation. We're seeing all the neat things that are happening, and we would like to do that. Now, being an engineer, I can come across as negative because I immediately tell you the reasons it might not work, right? We don't always come across as optimists as engineers. But I said, you know, this could be difficult. You don't have any past performance. There's no infrastructure. And I was laying out reasons that, I said, I want you to know it's not going to be easy. They very patiently listened to me. And then after I finished my little spiel, they said, well, what if we hire you as a consultant to help us figure all those things out? Because we'd like to do it, and we would just like to figure out how to do it. So I did. I said, no promises. And at the university, you could consult. I could do external consulting on my own, stuff like that. So one of the first calls I made was to the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, because I wanted to think, is it realistic that we try to start pushing the envelope as a tribe? And it just so happened, this is at the end of the Obama administration, the OSTP office said, actually, your timing couldn't be better because we've spent the last 6 months looking at using tribal sovereignty and collaborative partnerships with tribes to help unlock some of this regulatory gridlock we have in aviation. So we think you're perfectly suited to do that, which was kind of a go signal to not only me but the tribe. We said, okay, then we have something here. We have the ability to maybe make a big difference and a big impact. So we started doing all the regulatory analysis, synthesized kind of where I thought the industry would be going, how it would work for the tribe, what the business case would look like as we move forward. And as we had finished up all that analysis, the incoming Trump administration announced the Integration Pilot Program, which would be run by the FAA, which for the first time, an emerging transportation technology program actually allowed tribes to participate as lead participants. So we put in a proposal, very competitive, pool of states and others, and we won. And, it's somewhat funny because people didn't know who the Choctaw Nation was. We had no name recognition in aviation. Some of the early news stories consistently spelled Choctaw wrong. But we quickly started making a name for ourselves and bringing some very positive attention to the tribe. We've done a lot of historic firsts. We were the first tribe to be recognized as a public aircraft operator by the FAA, which is a major historical first. And we're setting all sorts of aviation records. We were the first entity in North America last summer to receive an FCC license to use protected C-band for a small UAS where we'd already received permission to fly beyond visual line of sight. So that was that combination and being able to do that was actually a historic first. And so we were very excited about that. But we're looking at this in multiple facets. We're building a very capable, sophisticated facility on that 44,600 acres. We have kind of a campus that's being built out, beautiful buildings, a lot of capability, a lot of test facilities, hangars. We've built out our own ground-based radar network. We built out our own ADS-B receiver network throughout the reservation. We've built out our own command and control radio network also. So we're making serious investments and effort on the infrastructure because we're very committed to safety. We consider ourselves a big partner in safety with the FAA and also the public. So we did win the IPP. We were the lead participant. Then we were invited to join the Beyond program, which Congress is poised now to make that a permanent program. So the Choctaw Nation will be a permanent partner with the FAA on a lot of this research and testing as part of that, what's going to be called Beyond. But we're very excited about that. But it's having a dramatic impact on the Choctaw Nation because when I grew up here, I didn't have a lot of STEM role models. I have a high school teacher who is actually Choctaw, and that was a time when the schools here had no money. We didn't pay our teachers well at all. It was just a poor area. But he had this passion to just expose us to as much as he could. And he would spend his own money and all kinds of things. And he just got us excited about science and technology. And eventually I found my way, into engineering. That's what I majored in, did all my graduate work in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that appealed to me coming back here was that coming back and making a difference, letting our youth see things happen in their backyard, which is tangible. You can come see things happen. You can touch things. You can participate. And it's already having a big impact on our STEM programs within the reservation. We're seeing an uptick in our high school graduates that are declaring engineering as their majors. We had one really good success story. I had a lady call me, and she said her niece was very interested in what she was doing. I think it was the summer between her junior and senior year. She said, can she just come visit? And I said, well, we'll do one better than that. I said, we'll make her part of a flight crew. She could come out and actually participate in some of the aviation testing and get to experience it, you know, firsthand. So she did. And a few days later, after that wrapped up, her aunt called back. She said she just won't stop talking about it. She keeps talking about how everyone collaborated and how neat it was. And that young lady is now an aerospace engineering major in college and doing very well. So we're seeing these dramatic impacts just on stimulating the future generations within the tribe to look at these neat things that are on the horizon. But in terms of the tribe in our internal operations, we have many things that we're looking at drones and UAS to help solve a lot of safety issues, a lot of sort of inequities that we have between rural and urban communities, you know, and it's like Jacob had talked about earlier, in the Choctaw Nation, it may take an ambulance, you know, 45 minutes or an hour or sometimes more to get to you, whereas in a city like Dallas or somewhere like that, it may take 4 to 7 minutes. And so that's life or death for many, many medical situations. And so we're looking at this technology to overcome some of those inequities we have with emergency health care, dealing with our inadequate transportation system. I also serve as Oklahoma State Transportation Commissioner for the 9 counties in southeastern Oklahoma, which is roughly the reservation boundary. There's not enough money on the horizons to get our rural highways and our roads up to the level of safety we need. The demand is outpacing what we're able to do on the ground. And so we're looking at things like UAS and advanced air mobility as opportunities to leapfrog, to use technology to equalize, to start to chip away at those really disturbing ground transportation fatality rates that we don't see in the air, but we do see on the ground.
Okay.
So it's very holistic. I'll kind of stop there.
All right. I mean, the possibilities here are just endless. It's so fascinating to consider. And James, one thing that really has me curious, how far away are we from having fully autonomous passenger aircraft? Because it seems like ultimately that's where all this is going to lead, is it not?
Sure. Yeah, there's a convergence of things. You know, as we started becoming more, you know, digital in the cockpits and fly-by-wire and all those things, it's led to the point now where automation is not difficult. It's more of a regulatory challenge than it is a technical challenge. But another thing has happened is we've seen over the past decade or more, I guess maybe 15, 20 years, the possibilities and feasibility of electric direct drive propulsion are enormous. We still have some issues with batteries, being able to get the energy densities and things we need for, you know, long duration flights. But all of those things are converging. And I actually do agree with Elon Musk in terms of automated transportation. There will be a time in the near future where we won't want humans doing it because the machines will be able to do it so much safer. Plus, that lets us do what we want to do. If you think about what people would rather do, would you rather be in traffic a long time in the morning driving? Or would you rather have your car drive you and let you do, you know, work for the office or text? That's what people would prefer to do. We're not very far away. It's more of a regulatory challenge. We have a lot of aircraft flying right now that can easily carry passengers. And so I'm thinking probably within the next decade, we're going to see something like that happen.
Because Jacob, I have heard, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard that the only task that they really need an actual human pilot in a cockpit for is to taxi to and from the runway. But once that plane's up in the air, once it takes off, once it lands, that can all be automated. Is that true?
That question is for me, right? James?
Yeah, James, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, even the ground transportation part. And what we're seeing is, if you think about 1930s, an airline pilot had to be very physically fit because you were literally physically manipulating control surfaces and aircraft. We moved away from the physical capabilities of pilots to more cognitive capabilities. And so pretty much a lot of the segments, we like to imagine that when the cockpit door closes on an airliner, that the pilots are up there, their feet are on the rudder pedals, they're manipulating the yoke, and they're just, you know, hands-on flying. The reality is the majority of the segments are already automated. And so we're not very far away. It's more of a human trust issue. That's the big issue.
Right.
It's similar to what we're dealing with artificial intelligence. What will the public trust, and what's the thresholds, and what's sort of the social contract in terms of regulations that we're going to put so that we make sure we exploit it for the benefits, but we can manage the negatives. And that's kind of where we're at with automated aviation.
Okay. Well, this is all just such an intriguing conversation that we're having here on Native America Calling today. Our guest, James Grimsley, he is the Executive Director of Advanced Technology Initiatives for the Choctaw Nation. And James, describing this aviation test range, hangars and other facilities there, about how long before you think this will all be built up and fully operational?
We already have operating complex with hangars and facilities and buildings. We're building the next phase, which will be completed. Half will be completed in July. The other half will be completed in January. Then we're going to go ahead and move to the next phase, which will be some additional test facilities, additional hangars. We're already working with quite a few companies. One of the neat things about this is 10 years ago, we would not have been able to get CEOs of large aviation companies to come visit us. Now, not only do they come visit, they stay because they want to see the first flights of something. They want to experience it. It's been a tremendous economic development opportunity for us. But I would say our plans, as you know, tribes have a long horizon for planning. And having worked in all forms of government, no form of government plans on the horizon that a tribe does, because tribes are patient. The generational thinking is just built in to everything we do, how we plan. So we have a long-term goal over the next, you know, we're designing things that need to be relevant in 20 or 30 years. And that's the horizon the Choctaw Nation is looking at in terms of our investments and how we really think the benefits are going to play out.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to take a caller, and we're also going to hear from Robert Hart, who is with LIDAR Drone Services in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Stay with us, listeners. We'll be right back.
Support for this program provided by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, the collective spirit and unifying voice of 35 tribal colleges and universities. For over 45 years, AHEC has worked to ensure that tribal sovereignty is recognized and respected, and that tribal colleges and universities are included in this nation's higher education system. Information on a tribal college or university near you at AIHEC.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we still have plenty of time for you to join our conversation today about drones. Give us a call. Phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. And let's take another caller now. Deborah, who is listening on KCUW in Pendleton, Oregon. Hello, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
That's me, Sean. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. I understand, Deborah, you do drone work yourself.
Yeah, we do. I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation, and I work for a tribally owned company called Cayuse Native Solutions. We're based in Oregon, and we started offering drone services last year. And so we do a variety of services, and it's just very inspiring to hear a lot of other tribes and Native people from both the United States and Canada also getting into drone technology.
Well, tell us about some of the applications you folks are working on with drones there at Cayuse Native Solutions.
Sure. Well, one of the specialty areas that we have been focusing in on is LIDAR mapping and LIDAR data collection for tribes here in the Northwest. We want to help tribes gather data that they need so they can make informed decisions about natural resources. One specific example I can share is we worked with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission recently, and we gathered some drone data, some LIDAR data for them along the Columbia River where the Klickitat River empties in. And they've been able to take that data and help make some decisions about how they manage that area, particularly for salmon restoration.
All right, now that's exciting, Deborah. And these are the types of projects that I think our listeners are really interested in when tribes are able to use this modern technology to address issues that our communities have been dealing with for millennia. So thank you so much for that call, Deborah, calling in from Pendleton, Oregon. Cayuse Native Solutions. And speaking of LIDAR, as Deborah mentions, that's a great segue for our next guest, Robert Hart, who is the owner and chief pilot of LIDAR Drone Services. Robert, hello, and welcome to the show again.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing great. We're doing great. So let's talk more about the kind of work you're doing. I know your company uses drones on different projects, but let's start with your construction projects. What exactly are the drones doing in those applications?
Well, when it comes to like construction mapping and volumetric measurements and whatnot, we're using RTK-enabled drones combined with base stations and ground control points, and we're actually providing tribes or nations that have current or future construction projects going on. A lot of times, historically, they haven't had a way to have a check and balance for that. Say the general contractor said, we're going to need 1 million cubic feet of gravel for this project. Well, historically, the tribes have never had a way. They just kind of had to take the word of the general contractor that that's how much volume they had on site. If they needed more, they underestimated, blah, blah, blah. So we provide a service for tribes and nations that for construction specifically, yep, we can do volumetric control, mapping, 3D modeling. And then from there, it kind of transitioned where we do 3D modeling for cemeteries. We also do ground terrestrial LIDAR, like Matterport scans of historical sites for tribes. But what's kind of providing us with a unique scenario is that I'm a certified thermographer. I hold 3 different thermography certifications through FLIR's Infrared Training Center. FLIR is if not the world leader in thermal imaging cameras. They do a lot of thermal imaging cameras, provide cameras for like Department of Defense and whatnot in that sector. But I hold a Level 1 and Level 2 drone thermography certification through them. There's only about 30 drone operators in the world certified at Level 2 through FLIR's ITC program. I happen to be one of them, and that provides me with a unique background and experience of doing thermal imaging for not only tribes and nations, but just companies all over the place. So we do a lot of thermal inspections, whether that be solar, moisture, a bunch of different things, but LIDAR is definitely included. LIDAR is more of a use case scenario. A lot of the times where you're asking clients what they would like and find out what the deliverable is that they prefer, and then work our way backwards from there on what is the best way to provide that for them.
Robert, so there's just so many working parts here. In one of the tasks that you described, I just find really interesting how using drone technology, you can measure how many millions of cubic feet, for example, a construction project needs for gravel uses. Can you explain exactly how, what is the pilot doing? What is the drone doing to collect that data precisely to know exactly how much gravel is needed for a project?
Well, a lot of it's photogrammetry. And so that's utilizing an RTK-enabled drone.
I'm sorry, real quick. RTK stands for?
Real-time kinetics, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Kinematics.
Go ahead, Robert.
Sorry.
Okay, real-time kinematics.
Real-time kinematics.
Gotcha.
That enables the drone to communicate with more accurately with the satellites. It's, you know, so a lot of drones, when they fly, they'll just be on GPS. So if you have an RTK-enabled or capable drone, a lot of DJI products for the consumer levels don't have RTK. You have to get up to their enterprise-level drones, which is like their Mavic series, M300s and whatnot. Those are RTK capable and ready. And then we'll either combine with a state's NTRIP network or a Coors network, which is essentially a state-provided access port to their system to tie into the satellites and their ground stations that they have spread out throughout the state. So now you can do that, or we also have our own base stations that we take out with a base station and a rover and let that run data for a little bit in particular spots. And then we also take, and this is a lot of just technical stuff, but then we also take out ground control points, or if we're working with the ground general contractor, you know, a lot of times they have their own surveyors already on site, and we work with their surveyors to use their already known survey points in conjunction with our work to provide it just a little bit more accuracy. Something to note is that a base station will provide more accuracy than like connecting through their online NTRIP or Coors network. So when it comes to tribal things and volumetric measurements and cut and fill and things like that, we definitely use our base station and rover to get our points to connect with like our ground control.
And Robert, how big is your team? Let's say you're going, like you're doing a mapping or a 3D modeling of cemeteries, for example. How many people do you actually have out there operating the drone and then just providing support?
It's usually just myself. It depends on the size project. Like, so I work with a couple different indigenous pilots that, you know, because we do other things beyond just drone work. You know, there's other things that work in conjunction, like something that we're doing for casinos. So I'll go through and provide them with a terrestrial LiDAR scan, Matterport scan, which provides the millimeter level accuracy to their gaming floor, and then come through and also do a thermal inspection to detect for any moisture intrusion, electrical, you know, a lot with gaming, there's a lot of electrical, you know, wires running through the walls, through the floors and whatnot. So we're able to combine those two technologies, and with my thermography background, I'm able to analyze in-house, provide our own reports, and then we combine them within our 3D models. So essentially, these organizations and tribes can take a virtual tour of their gaming floor, of their hotel, and then if there's any issues, it'll be noted within that model. They can click on that and have that thermal image pop up right within that. They can make notes and share that within their own organization. So for those kind of projects, we come in with a whole team, depends on how many floors it is. If it's a million square feet, you know, we're coming in with three or four different of us that'll come in. We all have Matterport. We all have thermal drone capabilities, RTK drones. We're all indigenous, and we're just kind of a little network that works over here together.
All right, now, you were talking with me a little bit before the show, because I expressed an interest in getting a drone myself as a hobbyist, but you explained that it's, you know, to do what you're doing and the other guests on the show, commercial drone projects, those are very different than what a hobbyist might do. Even somebody that just gets a drone and says, hey, I'm going to get a drone and take pictures of my roof and see if there's a leak. Even that people have to be careful about, don't they, with regard to regulation?
Absolutely. When it comes to the United States, your Part 107 is your quote unquote drone certificate. Well, underneath that, there's several different subsections and whatnot. And one of them explicitly states that it's the intention of the flight. So if anybody can fly a drone, you know, they provided it's a valid regulated drone, they have an RID chip. And they stay within that 400-foot ceiling as long as they're in uncontrolled airspace. But anybody can fly it with the intention that they're just going up to enjoy some pictures. Once that intent becomes anything commercial, whether those are just going to be used for his buddy's website, whether that's in talks with now with a company that we have, they have sites all over Oklahoma, Indiana, Illinois. What they do is they write grants for underprivileged income people and provide solar. So I started telling them about how reservations and whatnot are hub zones, and we're historically underutilized business areas. And I'm sure that that would also work hand in hand with underutilized communities. But just to spin that back around, they have been going out to sites and just having some of their employees fly the drone up, take pictures of roofs where they're going to be installing solar things. And from our meeting, after explaining that it's the intention of the flight, they realized that this entire time they've been doing something they shouldn't be. So we're trying to work that out and see if we can't get that all coordinated for them. Definitely comes to the intention of the flight. And there are several different layers, like I said, when it comes to airspace and what category of drone you have. Taken into consideration.
Robert, how long did it take you to get all of your training, all of your licenses, all of your certifications to qualify you to do the drone work you do now?
Man, I honestly did not know. I have a business degree from Central Michigan University with an emphasis in information systems. So in my mind, I had envisioned doing something like that for my community back here at Saginaw Chippewa Indian Reservation. But during my senior year, finishing up my degree, I had was also working as a natural resources technician for my tribe, and that put me out in the field a lot, got me interested. I got to fly their drone a couple times. So I took on a cartography certification through Central. And as I was doing my cartography cert, I happened to see a drone poster on the wall saying, hey, take this class and you'll get your, you'll be able to study for your Part 107. So I spoke to my advisor, I had some room for it, and then that was 2.5 years ago. And from there, I was a non-traditional student. I'm in my 40s, but I had went back to school to finish up. And yeah, from there, I got my drone certification. And then I also hunt, and I'm on a hunting show called Midwest Whitetail. And part of that from like hunting has introduced me to seeing thermal drones used for deer recovery. And when I had seen that, it got me interested in thermography. And so then there, I took it a step further and went down the FLIR Infrared Training Center path. And yeah, 3 certifications later, I have been doing thermal work for almost 14 months now. I plan on having my level 3, which would be a master thermographer certification, at the end of this year. And then I would envision goals of being able to go around to tribes and teach their maintenance departments, like preventative maintenance programs, the benefits for thermography and how to properly use a camera, the calibrations, things of that nature, to be able to, so tribes would be able to use these services themselves individually. And then, yeah, if they had big projects, you know, bring us in on a consulting thing or something like that.
Okay, this is all exciting, and congratulations, Robert, on all your success. And in amidst of all this, all your aviation, all your drone work, you're also a powwow dancer. And I'm curious, are you one of those people that take those really cool drone aerial shots of grand entries and stuff like that at powwows?
No, that's in the U.S., you cannot fly over people like that without a proper waiver. So, nope, that is not me. I'm usually one of the guys in grand entry. And then, yeah, that's come up. I've grown up dancing and singing at powwows all my life. My powwow jams is something I started. We were the first digital distribution outlet for Native American music in America. We've been all over recording live, 29 Palms, California, Rocky Boy, Montana. We live stream Gathering of Nations, their Stage 49. We did that for 3 years. We've live streamed Denver March powwow. Yeah, we did a lot within recording. Recorded Butch and Tone, Jermaine Bell, North Bear, Midnight Express, Iron Boy. Yeah, nope, it's been definitely a cool thing. So now that I'm into the technology aspect, I'm also a drone instructor here for the Mid-Michigan College organization. And then, yeah, hopefully maybe someday I'd move into bringing more STEM-related like that activities to tribal colleges.
And when you talk with your students, what are they most excited about with regard to learning how to pilot drones?
A lot of it's real-world applications. So we do 2 classes right now, and this is one for hobbyists. Unfortunately, their old drone instructor had passed away, and he had kept all the curriculum with them. So I'm working in conjunction with their staff to develop a whole new course curriculum for them. And one of them is hobbyist flying, just teaching basic. People don't want them to get their Part 107, just like what we was talking about, just going up and taking a couple of pictures for self-enjoyment. And then the second one is real-world drone applications. Yep, and people are really excited about the real-world applications, how to take the theory, quote-unquote, that we learn from the books and actually apply that out in the real world.
All right. Well, this is all just great information that we are learning about here on the show today. We are unfortunately out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up our drone discussion. But big thanks to our guests today, Jacob Taylor, James Grimsley, and Robert Hart, and also our callers who provided some great insights as well. Join us here again tomorrow as we take a look at infant and child immunization rates for Native Americans. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its first Tribal Leadership Academy August 4th to the 10th in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 1st, 2024.
OCO, April is National Alcohol Awareness Month. Join a support group to help yourself. If you have Medicaid or are insured through the marketplace, you may qualify for treatment options. For more information, contact your Indian healthcare provider or visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.